who are in danger and could use that favor to great advantage for a trade in high places. And you mean that you are reminding me of my promise to deliver the goods. The sort of performance he put on at his trial was hardly what I'd call delivering the goods, he said angrily. It wasn't what you had led me to expect. Oh, my, no, it wasn't, she said placidly. It certainly wasn't. But, darling, did you expect me not to know that after that performance of his, he wouldn't be very popular in high places? Did you really think you had to tell me that as a confidential favor? But it's true. I heard him discussed, so I thought I'd tell you. I'm sure it's true. I know that they would be discussing him. I know also that if there were anything they could do to him, they would have done it right after his trial. My, would they have been glad to do it. So I know that he's the only one among you who is in no danger whatever at the moment. I know that it's they who are afraid of him. Do you see how well I understand what you mean, darling? Well, if you think you do, I must say that for my part, I don't understand you at all. I don't know what it is you're doing. Why, I'm just setting things straight, so that you'll know that I know how much you need me. And now that it's straight, I'll tell you the truth in my turn. I didn't double-cross you. I merely failed. His performance at the trial, I didn't expect it any more than you did. Less. I had good reason not to expect it. But something went wrong. I don't know what it was. I am trying to find out. When I do, I will keep my promise. Then you'll be free to take full credit for it and to tell your friends in high places that it's you who've disarmed him. Lillian, he said nervously, I meant it when I said that I was anxious to give you proof of my friendship. So if there's anything I can do for... She laughed. There isn't. I know you meant it, but there's nothing you can do for me. No favor of any kind. No trade. I'm a truly non-commercial person. I want nothing in return. Tough luck, Jim. You'll just have to remain at my mercy. But then why should you want to do it at all? What are you getting out of it? She leaned back, smiling. This lunch. Just seeing you here. Just knowing that you had to come to me. An angry spark flashed in Taggart's veiled eyes. Then his eyelids narrowed slowly, and he too leaned back in his chair, his face relaxing to a faint look of mockery and satisfaction. Even from within that unstated, unnamed, undefined muck which represented his code of values, he was able to realize which one of them was the more dependent on the other, and the more contemptible. When they parted at the door of the restaurant, she went to Reardon's suite at the Wayne Falkland Hotel, where she stayed occasionally in his absence. She paced the room for about half an hour, in a leisurely manner of reflection. Then she picked up the telephone with a smoothly casual gesture, but with the purposeful air of a decision reached. She called Reardon's office at the Mills and asked Miss Ives when she expected him to return. "Mr. Reardon will be in New York tomorrow, arriving on the Comet, Mrs. Reardon," said Miss Ives' clear, courteous voice. "Tomorrow? That's wonderful. Miss Ives, would you do me a favor? Would you call Gertrude at the house and tell her not to expect me for dinner? I'm staying in New York overnight." She hung up, glanced at her watch, and called the florist of the Wayne Falkland. "This is Mrs. Henry Reardon," she said. "I should like to have 2 dozen roses delivered to Mr. Reardon's drawing-room aboard the Comet." "Yes, today, this afternoon, when the Comet reaches Chicago?" "No, without any card. Just the flowers. Thank you ever so much." She telephoned James Taggart. "Jim, Will you send me a pass to your passenger platforms? I want to meet my husband at the station tomorrow." She hesitated between Balfe Eubank and Bertram Scudder, chose Balfe Eubank, telephoned him and made a date for this evening's dinner and a musical show. Then she went to take a bath and lay relaxing in a tub of warm water, reading a magazine devoted to problems of political economy. It was late afternoon when the florist telephoned her. "Our Chicago office sent word that they were unable to deliver the flowers, Mrs. Reardon," he said, "because Mr. Reardon is not aboard the Comet."
"Are you sure?" she asked.
"Quite sure, Mrs. Reardon. Our man found at the station in Chicago that there was no compartment on the train reserved in Mr. Reardon's name. We checked with the New York office of Taggart Transcontinental just to make certain, and were told that Mr. Reardon's name is not on the passenger list of the Comet."
"I see.
Then cancel the order, please.
Thank you."
She sat by the telephone for a moment, frowning, then called Miss Ives.
"Please forgive me for being slightly scatterbrained, Miss Ives, but I was rushed and did not write it down, and now I'm not quite certain of what you said. Did you say that Mr. Reardon was coming back tomorrow? On the Comet?"
"Yes, Mrs. Reardon."
"You have not heard of any delay or change in his plans?"
"Why, no. In fact, I spoke to Mr. Reardon about an hour ago. He telephoned from the station in Chicago, and he mentioned that he had to hurry back aboard, as the Comet was about to leave."
"I see. Thank you."
She leaped to her feet as soon as the click of the instrument restored her to privacy. She started pacing the room, her steps now unrhythmically tense. Then she stopped, struck by a sudden thought. There was only one reason why a man would make a train reservation under an assumed name: if he was not traveling alone. Her facial muscles went flowing slowly into a smile of satisfaction. This was an opportunity she had not expected. Standing on the terminal platform at a point halfway down the length of the train, Lillian Reardon watched the passengers descending from the Comet. Her mouth held the hint of a smile. There was a spark of animation in her lifeless eyes. She glanced from one face to another, jerking her head with the awkward eagerness of a schoolgirl. She was anticipating the look on Reardon's face when, with his mistress beside him, he would see her standing there. Her glance darted hopefully to every flashy young female stepping off the train. It was hard to watch. Within an instant after the first few figures, the train had seemed to burst at the seams, flooding the platform with a solid current that swept in one direction, as if pulled by a vacuum. She could barely distinguish separate persons. The lights were more glare than illumination, picking this one strip out of a dusty, oily darkness. She needed an effort to stand still against the invisible pressure of motion. Her first sight of Reardon in the crowd came as a shock. She had not seen him step out of a car, but there he was, walking in her direction from somewhere far down the length of the train. He was alone. He was walking with his usual purposeful speed, his hands in the pockets of his trench coat. There was no woman beside him, no companion of any kind, except a porter hurrying along with a bag she recognized as his. In a fury of incredulous disappointment, she looked frantically for any single feminine figure he could have left behind. She felt certain that she would recognize his choice. She saw none that could be possible. And then she saw that the last car of the train was a private car, and that the figure standing at its door, talking to some station official, a figure wearing not minks and veils, but a rough sports coat that stressed the incomparable grace of a slender body in the confident posture of this station's owner and center, was Dagny Taggart. Then Lillian Reardon understood.
"Lillian, what's the matter?"
She heard Reardon's voice. She felt his hand grasping her arm. She saw him looking at her as one looks at the object of a sudden emergency. He was looking at a blank face and an unfocused glance of terror.
"What happened? What are you doing here?"
Hello, Henry. I just came to meet you. No special reason. I just wanted to meet you.
The terror was gone from her face, but she spoke in a strange, flat voice.
I wanted to see you. It was an impulse, a sudden impulse, and I couldn't resist it because...
But you looked ill.
No. No, maybe I felt faint. It's stuffy here. I couldn't resist coming, because it made me think of the days when you would have been glad to see me. It was a moment's illusion to recreate for myself.
The words sounded like a memorized lesson. She knew that she had to speak, while her mind was fighting to grasp the full meaning of her discovery. The words were part of the plan she had intended to use if she had met him after he had found the roses in his compartment. He did not answer. He stood watching her, frowning.
I missed you, Henry. I know what I am confessing, but I don't expect it to mean anything to you any longer.
The words did not fit the tight face, the lips that moved with effort, the eyes that kept glancing away from him down the length of the platform.
I merely wanted to surprise you.
A look of shrewdness and purpose was returning to her face. He took her arm, but she drew back a little too sharply.
Aren't you going to say a word to me, Henry?
What do you wish me to say?
Do you hate it as much as that? Having your wife come to meet you at the station?
She glanced down the platform. Dagny Taggart was walking toward them. He did not see her. Let's go, he said. She would not move.
Do you? She asked.
What?
Do you hate it?
No, I don't hate it. I merely don't understand it.
Tell me about your trip. I'm sure you've had a very enjoyable trip.
Come on, we can talk at home.
When do I ever have a chance to talk to you at home?
She was drawling her words impassively, as if she were stretching them to fill time, for some reason which he could not imagine.
I had hoped to catch a few moments of your attention, like this, between trains and business appointments and all those important matters that hold you day and night, all those great achievements of yours, such as...
Hello, Miss Taggart, she said sharply, her voice loud and bright. Reardon whirled around. Dagny was walking past them, but she stopped.
How do you do?
She said to Lillian, bowing, her face expressionless.
I am so sorry, Miss Taggart, said Lillian, smiling. You must forgive me if I don't know the appropriate formula of condolences for the occasion.
She noted that Dagny and Reardon had not greeted each other.
You're returning from what was, in effect, the funeral of your child by my husband, aren't you?
Dagny's mouth showed a faint line of astonishment and of contempt. She inclined her head by way of leave-taking and walked on. Lillian glanced sharply at Reardon's face, as if in deliberate emphasis. He looked at her indifferently, puzzled. She said nothing. She followed him without a word when he turned to go. She remained silent in the taxicab, her face half-turned away from him, while they rode to the Wayne Falkland Hotel. He felt certain, as he looked at the tautly twisted set of her mouth, that some uncustomary violence was raging within her. He had never known her to experience a strong emotion of any kind. She whirled to face him the moment they were alone in his room.
"So that's who it is?" she asked.
He had not expected it. He looked at her, not quite believing that he had understood it correctly.
"It's Dagny Taggart who is your mistress, isn't she?"
He did not answer.
"I happen to know that you had no compartment on that train, so I know where you've slept for the last 4 nights. Do you want to admit it, or do you want me to send detectives to question her train crews and her house servants? Is it Dagny Taggart?"
"Yes," he answered calmly.
Her mouth twisted into an ugly chuckle. She was staring past him.
I should have known it. I should have guessed.
That's why it didn't work. He asked, in blank bewilderment, what didn't work? She stepped back, as if to remind herself of his presence.
Had you... When she was in our house at the party, had you then...
No. Since.
The great businesswoman, she said, above reproach and feminine weaknesses. The great mind, detached from any concern with the body.
She chuckled.
The bracelet, she said, with the still look that made it sound as if the words were dropped accidentally out of the torrent in her mind. That's what she meant to you. That's the weapon she gave you.
If you really understand what you're saying, yes.
Do you think I'll let you get away with it?
Get away? He was looking at her incredulously, in cold, astonished curiosity.
That's why, at your trial...
She stopped. What about my trial? She was trembling.
You know, of course, that I won't allow this to continue.
What does it have to do with my trial?
I won't permit you to have her. Not her. Anyone but her.
He let a moment pass, then asked evenly, Why?
I won't permit it. You'll give it up.
He was looking at her without expression, but the steadiness of his eyes hit her as his most dangerous answer.
You'll give it up. You'll leave her. You'll never see her again.
Lillian, if you wish to discuss it, there's one thing you'd better understand. Nothing on earth will make me give it up.
But I demand it.
I told you that you could demand anything but that.
He saw the look of a peculiar panic growing in her eyes. It was not the look of understanding, but of a ferocious refusal to understand, as if she wanted to turn the violence of her emotion into a fog screen, as if she hoped not that it would blind her to reality, but that her blindness would make reality cease to exist.
But I have the right to demand it. I own your life. It's my property. My property. By your own oath. You swore to serve my happiness. Not yours. Mine. What have you done for me? You've given me nothing. You've sacrificed nothing. You've never been concerned with anything but yourself. Your work, your mills, your talent, your mistress. What about me? I hold first claim. I'm presenting it for collection. You're the account I own.
It was the look on his face that drove her up the rising steps of her voice, scream by scream, into terror. She was seeing not anger or pain or guilt, but the one inviolate enemy, indifference.
Have you thought of me? She screamed, her voice breaking against his face. Have you thought of what you're doing to me? You have no right to go on, if you know that you're putting me through hell every time you sleep with that woman. I can't stand it. I can't stand one moment of knowing it. Will you sacrifice me to your animal desire? Are you as vicious and selfish as that? Can you buy your pleasure at the price of my suffering? Can you have it, if this is what it does to me?
Feeling nothing but the emptiness of wonder, he observed the thing which he had glimpsed briefly in the past and was now seeing in the full ugliness of its futility. The spectacle of pleas for pity delivered in snarling hatred as threats and as demands. Lillian, he said very quietly, I would have it, even if it took your life.
She heard it. She heard more than he was ready to know and to hear in his own words. The shock to him was that she did not scream in answer, but that he saw her instead shrinking down into calm.
"You have no right,"
she said dully. It had the embarrassing helplessness of the words of a person who knows her own words to be meaningless. "Whatever claim you may have on me," he said, "no human being can hold on another a claim demanding that he wipe himself out of existence."
"Does she mean as much as that to you?"
"Much more than that." The look of thought was returning to her face, but in her face it had the quality of a look of cunning. She remained silent. "Lillian, I'm glad that you know the truth. Now you can make a choice with full understanding. You may divorce me, or you may ask that we continue as we are. That is the only choice you have. It is all I can offer you. I think you know that I want you to divorce me. But I don't ask for sacrifices. I don't know what sort of comfort you can find in our marriage, but if you do, I won't ask you to give it up. I don't know why you should want to hold me now. I don't know what it is that I mean to you. I don't know what you're seeking, what form of happiness is yours, or what you will obtain from a situation which I see as intolerable for both of us. By every standard of mine, you should have divorced me long ago. By every standard of mine, to maintain our marriage will be a vicious fraud. But my standards are not yours. I do not understand yours, I never have. But I will accept them. If this is the manner of your love for me, if bearing the name of my wife will give you some form of contentment, I won't take it away from you. It's I who've broken my word, so I will atone for it to the extent I can. You know, of course, that I could buy one of those modern judges and obtain a divorce any time I wished. I won't do it. I will keep my word, if you so desire, but this is the only form in which I can keep it. Now make your choice. But if you choose to hold me, you must never speak to me about her. You must never show her that you know. If you meet her in the future, you must never touch that part of my life. She stood still, looking up at him, the posture of her body slouched and loose, as if its sloppiness were a form of defiance, as if she did not care to resume for his sake the discipline of a graceful bearing.
"Miss Dagny Taggart," she said, and chuckled.
The superwoman whom common, average wives were not supposed to suspect. The woman who cared for nothing but business and dealt with men as a man. The woman of great spirit who admired you platonically just for your genius, your mills, and your metal. She chuckled. "I should have known that she was just a bitch who wanted you in the same way as any bitch would want you, because you are fully as expert in bed as you are at a desk, if I am a judge of such matters. But she would appreciate that better than I, since she worships expertness of any kind, and since she has probably been laid by every section hand on her railroad." She stopped, because she saw for the first time in her life by what sort of look one learns that a man is capable of killing. But he was not looking at her. She was not sure whether he was seeing her at all or hearing her voice. He was hearing his own voice saying her words, saying them to Dagny in the sun-striped bedroom of Ellis Wyatt's house. He was seeing, in the nights behind him, Dagny's face in those moments when, his body leaving hers, she lay still with a look of radiance that was more than a smile, a look of youth, of early morning, of gratitude to the fact of one's own existence. And he was seeing Lillian's face,
as he had seen it in bed beside him, a lifeless face with evasive eyes, with some feeble sneer on its lips and a look of sharing some smutty guilt. He saw who was the accuser and who the accused. He saw the obscenity of letting impotence hold itself as virtue and damn the power of living as a sin. He saw, with the clarity of direct perception, in the shock of a single instant, the terrible ugliness of that which had once been his own belief. It was only an instant, a conviction without words, a knowledge grasped as a feeling, left unsealed by his mind. The shock brought him back to the sight of Lillian and to the sound of her words. She appeared to him suddenly as some inconsequential presence that had to be dealt with at the moment. "Lillian," he said, in an unstressed voice that did not grant her even the honor of anger, "you are not to speak of her to me. If you ever do it again, I will answer you as I would answer a hoodlum. I will beat you up. Neither you nor anyone else is to discuss her." She glanced at him. "Really?" she said. It had an odd, casual sound, as if the word were tossed away, leaving some hook implanted in her mind. She seemed to be considering some sudden vision of her own. He said quietly, in weary astonishment, "I thought you would be glad to discover the truth. I thought you would prefer to know, for the sake of whatever love or respect you felt for me, that if I betrayed you, it was not cheaply and casually, it was not for a chorus girl, but for the cleanest and most serious feeling of my life." The ferocious spring with which she whirled to him was involuntary, as was the naked twist of hatred in her face. "Oh, you goddamn fool!" He remained silent. Her composure returned, with a faint suggestion of a smile of secret mockery. "I believe you're waiting for my answer," she said. "No, I won't divorce you. Don't ever hope for that. We shall continue as we are, if that is what you offered, and if you think it can continue. See whether you can flout all moral principles and get away with it." He did not listen to her while she reached for her coat, telling him that she was going back to their home. He barely noticed it when the door closed after her. He stood motionless, held by a feeling he had never experienced before. He knew that he would have to think later, to think and understand, but for the moment he wanted nothing but to observe the wonder of what he felt. It was a sense of freedom, as if he stood alone in the midst of an endless sweep of clean air, with only the memory of some weight that had been torn off his shoulders. It was the feeling of an immense deliverance. It was the knowledge that it did not matter to him what Lillian felt, what she suffered, or what became of her. And more, not only that it did not matter, but the shining, guiltless knowledge that it did not have to matter. Chapter 6. Miracle Medal. "But can we get away with it?" asked Wesley Mouch. His voice was high with anger and thin with fear. Nobody answered him. James Taggart sat on the edge of an armchair, not moving, looking up at him from under his forehead. Orrin Boyle gave a vicious tap against an ashtray, shaking the ash off his cigar. Dr. Floyd Ferris smiled. Dr. Weatherby folded his lips and hands. Fred Kinnon, head of the Amalgamated Labor of America, stopped pacing the office, sat down on the windowsill and crossed his arms. Eugene Lawson, who had sat hunched downward, absent-mindedly rearranging a display of flowers on a low glass table, raised his torso resentfully and glanced up. Mouch sat at his desk, with his fist on a sheet of paper. It was Eugene Lawson who answered. "That's not, it seems to me, the way to put it. We must not let vulgar difficulties obstruct our feeling that it's a noble plan motivated solely by the public welfare. It's for the good of the people. The people need it.
Need comes first, so we don't have to consider anything else. Nobody objected or picked it up. They looked as if Lawson had merely made it harder to continue the discussion. But a small man who sat unobtrusively in the best armchair of the room, apart from the others, content to be ignored and fully aware that none of them could be unconscious of his presence, glanced at Lawson, then at Mouch, and said with brisk cheerfulness, "That's the line, Wesley. Tone it down and dress it up and get your press boys to chant it, and you won't have to worry." "Yes, Mr. Thompson," said Mouch glumly. Mr. Thompson, the head of the state, was a man who possessed the quality of never being noticed. In any group of three, his person became indistinguishable, and when seen alone, it seemed to evoke a group of its own, composed of the countless persons he resembled. The country had no clear image of what he looked like. His photographs had appeared on the covers of magazines as frequently as those of his predecessors in office, but people could never be quite certain which photographs were his and which were pictures of a mail clerk or a white-collar worker, accompanying articles about the daily life of the undifferentiated, except that Mr. Thompson's collars were usually wilted. He had broad shoulders and a slight body. He had stringy hair, a wide mouth, and an elastic age range that made him look like a harassed 40 or an unusually vigorous 60. Holding enormous official powers, he schemed ceaselessly to expand them, because it was expected of him by those who had pushed him into office. He had the cunning of the unintelligent and the frantic energy of the lazy. The sole secret of his rise in life was the fact that he was a product of chance, and knew it, and aspired to nothing else. "It's obvious that measures have to be taken. Drastic measures," said James Taggart, speaking not to Mr. Thompson, but to Wesley Mouch. "We can't let things go the way they're going much longer." His voice was belligerent and shaky.
"Take it easy, Jim," said Orrin Boyle.
"Something's got to be done, and done fast."
"Don't look at me," snapped Wesley Mouch. "I can't help it. I can't help it if people refuse to cooperate. I'm tied. I need wider powers."
Mouch had summoned them all to Washington as his friends and personal advisers for a private, unofficial conference on the national crisis. But watching him, they were unable to decide whether his manner was overbearing or whining, whether he was threatening them or pleading for their help.
"Fact is," said Mr. Weatherby primly, in a statistical tone of voice, "that in the 12-month period ending on the 1st of this year, the rate of business failures has doubled as compared with the preceding 12-month period. Since the 1st of this year, it has trebled."
"Be sure they think it's their own fault," said Dr. Ferris casually.
"Huh?" said Wesley Mouch, his eyes darting to Ferris.
"Whatever you do, don't apologize," said Dr. Ferris. "Make them feel guilty."
"I'm not apologizing," snapped Mouch. "I'm not to blame. I need wider powers."
"But it is their own fault," said Eugene Lawson, turning aggressively to Dr. Ferris.
"It's their lack of social spirit. They refuse to recognize that production is not a private choice, but a public duty. They have no right to fail, no matter what conditions happen to come up. They've got to go on producing. It's a social imperative. A man's work is not a personal matter, it's a social matter. There's no such thing as a personal matter or a personal life. That's what we've got to force them to learn."
"Gene Lawson knows what I'm talking about," said Dr. Ferris with a slight smile, "even though he hasn't the faintest idea that he does."
"What do you think you mean?" asked Lawson, his voice rising.
"Skip it," ordered Wesley Mouch.
"I don't care what you decide to do, Wesley," said Mr. Thompson, "and I don't care if the businessmen squawk about it. Just be sure you've got the press with you. Be damn sure about that."
"I've got 'em," said Mouch.
"One editor who'd open his trap at the wrong time could do us more harm than 10 disgruntled millionaires."
"That's true, Mr. Thompson," said Dr. Ferris.
But can you name one editor who knows it?
Guess not, said Mr. Thompson. He sounded pleased.
Whatever type of men we're counting on and planning for, said Dr. Ferris, there's a certain old-fashioned quotation which we may safely forget. The one about counting on the wise and the honest.
We don't have to consider them. They're out of date.
James Taggart glanced at the window. There were patches of blue in the sky above the spacious streets of Washington, the faint blue of mid-April, and a few beams breaking through the clouds. A monument stood shining in the distance, hit by a ray of sun. It was a tall white obelisk, erected to the memory of the man Dr. Ferris was quoting, the man in whose honor this city had been named. James Taggart looked away.
I don't like the professor's remarks, said Lawson loudly and sullenly.
Keep still, said Wesley Mouch. Dr. Ferris is not talking theory, but practice.
Well, if you want to talk practice, said Fred Kinnan, then let me tell you that we can't worry about businessmen at a time like this. What we've got to think about is jobs. More jobs for the people. In my unions, every man who's working is feeding five who aren't, not counting his own pack of starving relatives. If you want my advice, oh, I know you won't go for it, but it's just a thought, issue a directive making it compulsory to add, say, one-third more men to every payroll in the country.
Good God, yelled Taggart. Are you crazy? We can barely meet our payrolls as it is. There's not enough work for the men we've got now. One-third more? We wouldn't have any use for them, whatever.
Who cares whether you'd have any use for them, said Fred Kinnan. They need jobs. That's what comes first. Need. Doesn't it? Not your profits.
It's not a question of profits, yelled Taggart hastily. I haven't said anything about profits. I haven't given you any grounds to insult me.
It's just a question of where in hell we'd get the money to pay your men, when half our trains are running empty and there's not enough freight to fill a trolley car.
His voice slowed down suddenly to a tone of cautious thoughtfulness.
However, we do understand the plight of the working man, and it's just a thought. We could perhaps take on a certain extra number if we were permitted to double our freight rates, which...
Have you lost your mind? Yelled Orrin Boyle. I'm going broke on the rates you're charging now. I shudder every time a damn boxcar pulls in or out of the mills. They're bleeding me to death. I can't afford it. And you want to double it?
It is not essential whether you can afford it or not, said Taggart coldly. You have to be prepared to make some sacrifices. The public needs railroads. Need comes first, above your profits.
What profits? Yelled Orrin Boyle. When did I ever make any profits? Nobody can accuse me of running a profit-making business. Just look at my balance sheet, and then look at the books of a certain competitor of mine, who's got all the customers, all the raw materials, all the technical advantages, and a monopoly on secret formulas. Then tell me who's the profiteer. But of course, the public does need railroads, and perhaps I could manage to absorb a certain raise in rates if I were to get... It's just a thought. If I were to get a subsidy to carry me over the next year or two until I catch my stride and...
What?
Again, yelled Mr. Weatherby, losing his primness. How many loans have you got from us, and how many extensions, suspensions, and moratoriums? You haven't repaid a penny. And with all of you boys going broke and the tax receipts crashing, where do you expect us to get the money to hand you a subsidy?
There are people who aren't broke, said Boyle slowly. You boys have no excuse for permitting all that need and misery to spread through the country, so long as there are people who aren't broke.
I can't help it, yelled Wesley Mouch.
I can't do anything about it. I need wider powers.
They could not tell what had prompted Mr. Thompson to attend this particular conference. He had said little, but had listened with interest. It seemed as if there was something which he had wanted to learn, and now he looked as if he had learned it. He stood up and smiled cheerfully.
"Go ahead, Wesley," he said. "Go ahead with number 10-289. You won't have any trouble at all."
They had all risen to their feet in gloomily reluctant deference. Wesley Mouch glanced down at his sheet of paper, then said in a petulant tone of voice,
"If you want me to go ahead, you'll have to declare a state of total emergency."
"I'll declare it any time you're ready."
"There are certain difficulties which—"
"I'll leave it up to you.
Work it out any way you wish. It's your job. Let me see the rough draft tomorrow or the next day, but don't bother me about the details. I've got a speech to make on the radio in half an hour."
"The chief difficulty is that I'm not sure whether the law actually grants us the power to put into effect certain provisions of Directive Number 10-289. I fear they might be open to challenge."
"Oh, hell. We've passed so many emergency laws that if you hunt through them, you're sure to dig up something that will cover it."
Mr. Thompson turned to the others with a smile of good fellowship.
"I'll leave you boys to iron out the wrinkles," he said. "I appreciate your coming to Washington to help us out. Glad to have seen you."
They waited until the door closed after him, then resumed their seats. They did not look at one another. They had not heard the text of Directive Number 10-289, but they knew what it would contain. They had known it for a long time, in that special manner which consisted of keeping secrets from oneself and leaving knowledge untranslated into words. And by the same method, they now wished it were possible for them not to hear the words of the directive. It was to avoid moments such as this that all the complex twistings of their minds had been devised. They wished the directive to go into effect. They wished it could be put into effect without words, so that they would not have to know that what they were doing was what it was. Nobody had ever announced that Directive Number 10-289 was the final goal of his efforts. Yet for generations past, men had worked to make it possible, and for months past, every provision of it had been prepared for by countless speeches, articles, sermons, editorials, by purposeful voices that screamed with anger if anyone named their purpose.
"The picture now is this," said Wesley Mouch. "The economic condition of the country was better the year before last than it was last year, and last year it was better than it is at present. It's obvious that we would not be able to survive another year of the same progression. Therefore, our sole objective must now be to hold the line, to stand still in order to catch our stride, to achieve total stability. Freedom has been given a chance and has failed. Therefore, more stringent controls are necessary. Since men are unable and unwilling to solve their problems voluntarily, they must be forced to do it."
He paused, picked up the sheet of paper, then added in a less formal tone of voice,
"Hell, what it comes down to is that we can manage to exist as and where we are, but we can't afford to move. So we've got to stand still. We've got to stand still. We've got to make those bastards stand still."
His head drawn into his shoulders, he was looking at them with the anger of a man declaring that the country's troubles were a personal affront to him. So many men seeking favors had been afraid of him that he now acted as if his anger were a solution to everything, as if his anger were omnipotent, as if all he had to do was to get angry. Yet, facing him, the men who sat in a silent semicircle before his desk were uncertain whether the presence of fear in the room was their own emotion, or whether the hunched figure behind the desk generated the panic of a cornered rat. Wesley Mouch had a long, square face and a flat-topped skull, made more so by a brush haircut. His lower lip was a petulant bulb, and the pale brownish pupils of his eyes looked like the yolks of eggs smeared under the not fully translucent whites. His facial features moved abruptly,
and the movement vanished, having conveyed no expression. No one had ever seen him smile. Wesley Mouch came from a family that had known neither poverty nor wealth nor distinction for many generations. It had clung, however, to a tradition of its own, that of being college-bred and, therefore, of despising men who were in business. The family's diplomas had always hung on the wall in the manner of a reproach to the world, because the diplomas had not automatically produced the material equivalents of their attested spiritual value. Among the family's numerous relatives, there was one rich uncle. He had married his money, and in his widowed old age, he had picked Wesley as his favorite from among his many nephews and nieces, because Wesley was the least distinguished of the lot, and therefore, thought Uncle Julius, the safest. Uncle Julius did not care for people who were brilliant. He did not care for the trouble of managing his money either. So he turned the job over to Wesley. By the time Wesley graduated from college, there was no money left to manage. Uncle Julius blamed it on Wesley's cunning and cried that Wesley was an unscrupulous schemer. But there had been no scheme about it. Wesley could not have said just where the money had gone. In high school, Wesley Mouch had been one of the worst students and had passionately envied those who were the best. College taught him that he did not have to envy them at all. After graduation, he took a job in the advertising department of a company that manufactured a bogus corn cure. The cure sold well, and he rose to be the head of his department. He left it to take charge of the advertising of a hair restorer, then of a patented brassiere, then of a new soap, then of a soft drink. And then he became advertising vice president of an automobile concern. He tried to sell automobiles as if they were a bogus corn cure. They did not sell. He blamed it on the insufficiency of his advertising budget. It was the president of the automobile concern who recommended him to Reardon. It was Reardon who introduced him to Washington. Reardon, who knew no standard by which to judge the activities of his Washington man. It was James Taggart who gave him a start in the Bureau of Economic Planning and National Resources, in exchange for double-crossing Reardon in order to help Orrin Boyle, in exchange for destroying Dan Conway. From then on, people helped Wesley Mouch to advance, for the same reason as that which had prompted Uncle Julius. They were people who believed that mediocrity was safe. The men who now sat in front of his desk had been taught that the law of causality was a superstition, and that one had to deal with the situation of the moment without considering its cause. By the situation of the moment, they had concluded that Wesley Mouch was a man of superlative skill and cunning, since millions aspired to power, but he was the one who had achieved it. It was not within their method of thinking to know that Wesley Mouch was the zero at the meeting point of forces unleashed in destruction against one another. "This is just a rough draft of Directive Number 10-289, said Wesley Mouch, "which Jean, Clem, and I have dashed off just to give you the general idea. We want to hear your opinions, suggestions, and so forth. You being the representatives of labor, industry, transportation, and the professions." Fred Kinnan got off the windowsill and sat down on the arm of a chair. Orrin Boyle spit out the butt of his cigar. James Taggart looked down at his own hands. Dr. Ferris was the only one who seemed to be at ease. "In the name of the general welfare," read Wesley Mouch, "to protect the people's security, to achieve full equality and total stability, it is decreed for the duration of the national emergency that, point one, all workers, wage earners, and employees of any kind whatsoever shall henceforth be attached to their jobs and shall not leave nor be dismissed nor change employment under penalty of a term in jail. The penalty shall be determined by the Unification Board, such board to be appointed by the Bureau of Economic Planning and National Resources. All persons reaching the age of 21 shall report to the Unification Board, which shall assign them to where, in its opinion, their services will best serve the interests of the nation. Point two. All industrial, commercial, manufacturing, and business establishments of any nature whatsoever shall henceforth remain in operation, and the owners of such establishments shall not quit
nor leave, nor retire, nor close, sell, or transfer their business, under penalty of the nationalization of their establishment and of any and all of their property. Point 3. All patents and copyrights pertaining to any devices, inventions, formulas, processes, and works of any nature whatsoever shall be turned over to the nation as a patriotic emergency gift by means of gift services to be signed voluntarily by the owners of all such patents and copyrights. The Unification Board shall then license the use of such patents and copyrights to all applicants, equally and without discrimination, for the purpose of eliminating monopolistic practices, discarding obsolete products, and making the best available to the whole nation. No trademarks, brand names, or copyrighted titles shall be used. Every formerly patented product shall be known by a new name and sold by all manufacturers under the same name, such name to be selected by the Unification Board. All private trademarks and brand names are hereby abolished. Point 4. No new devices, inventions, products, or goods of any nature whatsoever, not now on the market, shall be produced, invented, manufactured, or sold after the date of this directive. The Office of Patents and Copyrights is hereby suspended. Point 5. Every establishment, concern, corporation, or person engaged in production of any nature whatsoever shall henceforth produce the same amount of goods per year as it, they, or he produced during the basic year, no more and no less. The year to be known as the basic or yardstick year is to be the year ending on the date of this directive. Over or under production shall be fined, such fines to be determined by the Unification Board. Point 6. Every person of any age, sex, class, or income shall henceforth spend the same amount of money on the purchase of goods per year as he or she spent during the basic year, no more and no less. Over or under purchasing shall be fined, such fines to be determined by the Unification Board. Point 7. All wages, prices, salaries, dividends, profits, interest rates, and forms of income of any nature whatsoever shall be frozen at their present figures as of the date of this directive. Point 8. All cases arising from and rules not specifically provided for in this directive shall be settled and determined by the Unification Board, whose decisions will be final. There was, even within the four men who had listened, a remnant of human dignity, which made them sit still and feel sick for the length of 1 minute. James Taggart spoke first. His voice was low, but it had the trembling intensity of an involuntary scream. Well, why not? Why should they have it if we don't? Why should they stand above us? If we are to perish, let's make sure that we all perish together. Let's make sure that we leave them no chance to survive. That's a damn funny thing to say about a very practical plan that will benefit everybody, said Orrin Boyle shrilly, looking at Taggart in frightened astonishment. Dr. Ferris chuckled. Taggart's eyes seemed to focus, and he said, his voice louder, Yes, of course. It's a very practical plan. It's necessary, practical, and just. It will solve everybody's problems. It will give everybody a chance to feel safe. A chance to rest. It will give security to the people, said Eugene Lawson, his mouth slithering into a smile. Security? That's what the people want. If they want it, why shouldn't they have it? Just because a handful of rich will object? It's not the rich who will object, said Dr. Ferris lazily. The rich drool for security more than any other sort of animal. Haven't you discovered that yet? Well, who'll object? Snapped Lawson. Dr. Ferris smiled pointedly and did not answer. Lawson looked away. To hell with them. Why should we worry about them? We've got to run the world for the sake of the little people. It's intelligence that's caused all the troubles of humanity. Man's mind is the root of all evil. This is the day of the heart.
It's the weak, the meek, the sick and the humble that must be the only objects of our concern.
His lower lip was twisting in soft, lecherous motions. Those who are big are here to serve those who aren't. If they refuse to do their moral duty, we've got to force them. There once was an age of reason, but we've progressed beyond it. This is the age of love.
Shut up, screamed James Taggart.
They all stared at him.
For Christ's sake, Jim, what's the matter? Said Orrin Boyle, shaking.
Nothing, said Taggart. Nothing.
Wesley, keep him still, will you?
Mouch said uncomfortably,
But I fail to see.
Just keep him still. We don't have to listen to him, do we?
Why, no, but...
Then let's go on.
What is this? Demanded Lawson.
I resent it. I most emphatically...
But he saw no support in the faces around him and stopped, his mouth sagging into an expression of pouting hatred.
Let's go on, said Taggart feverishly.
What's the matter with you? Asked Orrin Boyle, trying not to know what was the matter with himself and why he felt frightened.
Genius is a superstition, Jim, said Dr. Ferris slowly,
with an odd kind of emphasis, as if knowing that he was naming the unnamed in all their minds.
There's no such thing as the intellect. A man's brain is a social product, a sum of influences that he's picked up from those around him. Nobody invents anything, he merely reflects what's floating in the social atmosphere. A genius is an intellectual scavenger and a greedy hoarder of the ideas which rightfully belong to society, from which he stole them. All thought is theft. If we do away with private fortunes, we'll have a fairer distribution of wealth. If we do away with the genius, we'll have a fairer distribution of ideas.
Are we here to talk business, or are we here to kid one another?
Asked Fred Kinnan. They turned to him. He was a muscular man with large features, but his face had the astonishing property of finely drawn lines that raised the corners of his mouth into the permanent hint of a wise, sardonic grin. He sat on the arm of the chair, hands in pockets, looking at Mouch with the smiling glance of a hardened policeman at a shoplifter.
All I've got to say is that you better staff that unification board with my men, he said. Better make sure of it, brother, or I'll blast your point one to hell.
I intend, of course, to have a representative of labor on that board, said Mouch dryly, as well as a representative of industry, of the professions, and of every cross-section of...
No cross-sections, said Fred Kinnan evenly. Just representatives of labor, period.
What the hell? Yelled Orrin Boyle. That's stacking the cards, isn't it?
Sure, said Fred Kinnan.
But that will give you a stranglehold on every business in the country.
What do you think I'm after?
That's unfair, yelled Boyle. I won't stand for it. You have no right. You...
Right, said Kinnan innocently. Are we talking about rights?
But I mean, after all, there are certain fundamental property rights which...
Listen, pal, you want point three, don't you?
Well, I...
Then you'd better keep your trap shut about property rights from now on. Keep it shut tight.
Mr. Kinnan, said Dr. Ferris, you must not make the old-fashioned mistake of drawing wide generalizations. Our policy has to be flexible. There are no absolute principles which...
Save it for Jim Taggart, Doc, said Fred Kinnan. I know what I'm talking about. That's because I never went to college.
I object, said Boyle, to your dictatorial method of...
Kinnan turned his back on him and said, Listen, Wesley, my boys won't like point one. If I get to run things, I'll make them swallow it. If not, not. Just make up your mind.
Well, said Mouch, and stopped. For Christ's sake, Wesley, what about us? Yelled Taggart.
You'll come to me, said Kinnan, when you'll need a deal to fix the board. But I'll run that board. Me and Wesley.
Do you think the country will stand for it?
Yelled Taggart.
Stop kidding yourself, said Kinnan. The country? If there aren't any principles anymore, and I guess the doc is right because there sure aren't, if there aren't any rules to this game and it's only a question of who robs whom, then I've got more votes than the bunch of you. There are more workers than employers, and don't you forget it, boys.
That's a funny attitude to take, said Taggart haughtily, about a measure which, after all, is not designed for the selfish benefit of workers or employers, but for the general welfare of the public.
Okay, said Kinnan amiably. Let's talk your lingo. Who is the public? If you go by quality, then it ain't you, Jim, and it ain't Ory Boyle. If you go by quantity, then it sure is me, because quantity is what I've got behind me. His smile disappeared, and with a sudden bitter look of weariness, he added, Only I'm not going to say that I'm working for the welfare of my public, because I know I'm not. I know that I'm delivering the poor bastards into slavery, and that's all there is to it. And they know it, too. But they know that I'll have to throw them a crumb once in a while if I want to keep my racket, while with the rest of you they wouldn't have a chance in hell. So that's why, if they've got to be under a whip, they'd rather I held it, not you. You drooling, tear-jerking, mealy-mouthed bastards of the public welfare— Do you think that outside of your college-bred pansies there's one village idiot whom you're fooling? I'm a racketeer, but I know it, and my boys know it, and they know that I'll pay off. Not out of the kindness of my heart, either, and not a cent more than I can get away with, but at least they can count on that much. Sure, it makes me sick sometimes. It makes me sick right now, but it's not me who's built this kind of world. You did. So I'm playing the game as you've set it up, and I'm going to play it for as long as it lasts, which isn't going to be long for any of us. He stood up. No one answered him. He let his eyes move slowly from face to face and stop on Wesley Mouch.
Do I get the board, Wesley? He asked casually.
The selection of the specific personnel is only a technical detail, said Mouch pleasantly. Suppose we discuss it later, you and I. Everybody in the room knew that this meant the answer yes.
Okay, pal, said Kinnan.
He went back to the window, sat down on the sill, and lighted a cigarette. For some unadmitted reason, the others were looking at Dr. Ferris, as if seeking guidance.
Don't be disturbed by oratory, said Dr. Ferris smoothly.
Mr. Kinnan is a fine speaker, but he has no sense of practical reality. He is unable to think dialectically. There was another silence. Then James Taggart spoke up suddenly.
I don't care. It doesn't matter. He'll have to hold things still. Everything will have to remain as it is, just as it is. Nobody will be permitted to change anything. Except, he turned sharply to Wesley Mouch.
Wesley, under point four, we'll have to close all research departments, experimental laboratories, scientific foundations, and all the rest of the institutions of that kind. They'll have to be forbidden.
Yes, that's right, said Mouch. I hadn't thought of that. We'll have to stick in a couple of lines about that.
He hunted around for a pencil and made a few scrawls on the margin of his paper.
It will end wasteful competition, said James Taggart. We'll stop scrambling to beat one another to the untried and the unknown. We won't have to worry about new inventions upsetting the market. We won't have to pour money down the drain in useless experiments just to keep up with overambitious competitors.
Yes, said Orrin Boyle. Nobody should be allowed to waste money on the new until everybody has plenty of the old. Close all those damn research laboratories, and the sooner, the better.
Yes, said Wesley Mouch. We'll close them. All of them.
The State Science Institute, too? Asked Fred Kinnan.
Oh, no, said Mouch.
That's different. That's government. Besides, it's a non-profit institution, and it will be sufficient to take care of all scientific progress.
Quite sufficient, said Dr. Ferris.
And what will become of all the engineers, professors, and such when you close all those laboratories? Asked Fred Kinnan. What are they going to do for a living, with all the other jobs and businesses frozen?
Oh, said Wesley Mouch. He scratched his head. He turned to Mr. Weatherby.
Do we put them on relief, Clem?
No, said Mr. Weatherby.
What for? There's not enough of them to raise a squawk. Not enough to matter.
I suppose, said Mouch, turning to Dr. Ferris, that you'll be able to absorb some of them, Floyd?
Some, said Dr. Ferris slowly, as if relishing every syllable of his answer. Those who prove cooperative.
What about the rest? Asked Fred Kinnan.
They'll have to wait till the Unification Board finds some use for them, said Wesley Mouch.
What will they eat while they're waiting?
Mouch shrugged. There's got to be some victims in times of national emergency. It can't be helped.
We have the right to do it,
cried Taggart suddenly, in defiance to the stillness of the room.
We need it. We need it, don't we?
There was no answer.
We have the right to protect our livelihood.
Nobody opposed him, but he went on with a shrill, pleading insistence.
We'll be safe for the first time in centuries.
Everybody will know his place and job, and everybody else's place and job. And we won't be at the mercy of every stray crank with a new idea. Nobody will push us out of business, or steal our markets, or undersell us, or make us obsolete. Nobody will come to us offering some damn new gadget and putting us on the spot to decide whether we'll lose our shirt if we buy it, or whether we'll lose our shirt if we don't, but somebody else does.
We won't have to decide.
Nobody will be permitted to decide anything.
It will be decided once and for all.
His glance moved pleadingly from face to face. There's been enough invented already. Enough for everybody's comfort. Why should they be allowed to go on inventing? Why should we permit them to blast the ground from under our feet every few steps? Why should we be kept on the go in eternal uncertainty? Just because of a few restless, ambitious adventurers? Should we sacrifice the contentment of the whole of mankind to the greed of a few nonconformists?
We don't need them.
We don't need them at all. I wish we'd get rid of that hero worship.
Heroes?
They've done nothing but harm all through history. They've kept mankind running a wild race with no breathing spell, no rest, no ease, no security.
Running to catch up with them.
Always, without end. Just as we catch up, they're years ahead.
They leave us no chance. They've never left us a chance.
His eyes were moving restlessly. He glanced at the window but looked hastily away. He did not want to see the white obelisk in the distance.
We're through with them.
We've won. This is our age. Our world.
We're going to have security. For the first time in centuries. For the first time since the beginning of the Industrial Revolution.
Well, this, I guess, said Fred Kinnan, is the anti-industrial revolution.
That's a damn funny thing for you to say, snapped Wesley Mouch. We can't be permitted to say that to the public.
Don't worry, brother. I won't say it to the public.
It's a total fallacy, said Dr. Ferris. It's a statement prompted by ignorance. Every expert has conceded long ago that a planned economy achieves the maximum of productive efficiency and that centralization leads to super-industrialization.
Centralization destroys the blight of monopoly, said Boyle.
How's that again? Drawled Kinnan.
Boyle did not catch the tone of mockery and answered earnestly,
It destroys the blight of monopoly. It leads to the democratization of industry. It makes everything available to everybody.
Now, for instance, at a time like this, when there's such a desperate shortage of iron ore, is there any sense in my wasting money, labor, and national resources on making old-fashioned steel, when there exists a much better metal that I could be making? A metal that everybody wants, but nobody can get. Now, is that good economics, or sound social efficiency, or democratic justice? Why shouldn't I be allowed to manufacture that metal, and why shouldn't the people get it when they need it? Just because of the private monopoly of one selfish individual? Should we sacrifice our rights to his personal interests?
Skip it, brother, said Fred Kinnan. I've read it all in the same newspapers you did.
I don't like your attitude, said Boyle, in a sudden tone of righteousness, with a look which, in a barroom, would have signified a prelude to a fistfight. He sat up straight, buttressed by the columns of paragraphs on yellow-tinged paper which he was seeing in his mind. At a time of crucial public need, are we to waste social effort on the manufacture of obsolete products? Are we to let the many remain in want while the few withhold from us the better products and methods available? Are we to be stopped by the superstition of patent rights? Is it not obvious that private industry is unable to cope with the present economic crisis? How long, for instance, are we going to put up with a disgraceful shortage of Reardon metal? There is a crying public demand for it, which Reardon has failed to supply. When are we going to put an end to economic injustice and special privileges? Why should Reardon be the only one permitted to manufacture Reardon metal?
I don't like your attitude, said Orrin Boyle. So long as we respect the rights of the workers, we'll want you to respect the rights of the industrialists.
Which rights of which industrialists? Drawled Kinnan.
I'm inclined to think, said Dr. Ferris hastily, that point two, perhaps, is the most essential one of all at present. We must put an end to that peculiar business of industrialists retiring and vanishing. We must stop them. It's playing havoc with our entire economy.
Why are they doing it? Asked Taggart nervously.
Where are they all going?
Nobody knows, said Dr. Ferris. We've been unable to find any information or explanation. But it must be stopped. In times of crisis, economic service to the nation is just as much of a duty as military service. Anyone who abandons it should be regarded as a deserter. I have recommended that we introduce the death penalty for those men, but Wesley wouldn't agree to it.
Take it easy, boy, said Fred Kinnan in an odd, slow voice.
He sat suddenly and perfectly still, his arms crossed, looking at Ferris in a manner that made it suddenly real to the room that Ferris had proposed murder.
Don't let me hear you talk about any death penalties in industry.
Dr. Ferris shrugged.
We don't have to go to extremes, said Mouch hastily. We don't want to frighten people. We want to have them on our side. Our top problem is, will they accept it at all?
They will, said Dr. Ferris.
I'm a little worried, said Eugene Lawson, about points three and four. Taking over the patents is fine. Nobody's going to defend industrialists. But I'm worried about taking over the copyrights. That's going to antagonize the intellectuals. It's dangerous. It's a spiritual issue. Doesn't point four mean that no new books are to be written or published from now on?
Yes, said Mouch, it does.
But we can't make an exception for the book publishing business. It's an industry like any other. When we say no new products, it's got to mean no new products.
But this is a matter of the spirit, said Lawson. His voice had a tone not of rational respect, but of superstitious awe.
We're not interfering with anybody's spirit. But when you print a book on paper, it becomes a material commodity. And if we grant an exception to one commodity, we won't be able to hold the others in line, and we won't be able to make anything stick.
Yes, that's true.
But don't be a chump, Jean, said Dr. Ferris. You don't want some recalcitrant hacks to come out with treatises that will wreck our entire program, do you? If you breathe the word censorship now, they'll all scream bloody murder. They're not ready for it. As yet. But if you leave the spirit alone and make it a simple material issue, not a matter of ideas, but just a matter of paper, ink, and printing presses, you accomplish your purpose much more smoothly. You'll make sure that nothing dangerous gets printed or heard, and nobody is going to fight over a material issue.
Yes, but I don't think the writers will like it.
Are you sure? Asked Wesley Mouch, with a glance that was almost a smile. Don't forget that under point 5, the publishers will have to publish as many books as they did in the basic year. Since there will be no new ones, they will have to reprint, and the public will have to buy some of the old ones. There are many very worthy books that have never had a fair chance.
Oh,
said Lawson. He remembered that he had seen Mouch lunching with Balf Eubank 2 weeks ago. Then he shook his head and frowned.
Still, I'm worried. The intellectuals are our friends. We don't want to lose them. They can make an awful lot of trouble.
They won't, said Fred Kinnan. Your kind of intellectuals are the first to scream when it's safe, and the first to shut their traps at the first sign of danger. They spend years spitting at the man who feeds them, and they lick the hand of the man who slaps their drooling faces. Didn't they deliver every country of Europe one after another to committees of goons, just like this one here? Didn't they scream their heads off to shut out every burglar alarm and to break every padlock open for the goons? Have you heard a peep out of them since? Didn't they scream that they were the friends of labor? Do you hear them raising their voices about the chain gangs, the slave camps, the 14-hour work day, and the mortality from scurvy in the people's states of Europe? No. But you do hear them telling the whip-beaten wretches that starvation is prosperity, that slavery is freedom, that torture chambers are brother love, and that if the wretches don't understand it, then it's their own fault that they suffer, and it's the mangled corpses in the jail cellars who are to blame for all their troubles, not the benevolent leaders. Intellectuals? You might have to worry about any other breed of men, but not about the modern intellectuals. They'll swallow anything. I don't feel so safe about the lousiest wharf rat in the Longshoremen's Union. He's liable to remember suddenly that he is a man, and then I won't be able to keep him in line. But the intellectuals? That's the one thing they've forgotten long ago. I guess it's the one thing that all their education was aimed to make them forget. Do anything you please to the intellectuals. They'll take it.
For once, said Dr. Ferris, I agree with Mr. Kinnan.
I agree with his facts, if not with his feelings. You don't have to worry about the intellectuals, Wesley. Just put a few of them on the government payroll and send them out to preach precisely the sort of thing Mr. Kinnan mentioned, that the blame rests on the victims. Give them moderately comfortable salaries and extremely loud titles, and they'll forget their copyrights and do a better job for you than whole squads of enforcement officers.
Yes, said Mouch, I know.
The danger that I'm worried about will come from a different quarter, said Dr. Ferris thoughtfully. You might run into quite a bit of trouble on that voluntary gift certificate business, Wesley.
I know, said Mouch glumly. That's the point I wanted Thompson to help us out on.
But I guess he can't. We don't actually have the legal power to seize the patents. Well, there's plenty of clauses in dozens of laws that can be stretched to cover it. Almost, but not quite. Any tycoon who'd want to make a test case would have a very good chance to beat us. And we have to preserve a semblance of legality, or the populace won't take it.
Precisely, said Dr. Ferris.
It's extremely important to get those patents turned over to us voluntarily.
Even if we had a law permitting outright nationalization, it would be much better to get them as a gift. We want to leave to people the illusion that they're still preserving their private property rights, and most of them will play along. They'll sign the gift certificates. Just raise a lot of noise about its being a patriotic duty, and that anyone who refuses is a prince of greed, and they'll sign. But he stopped.
I know,
said Mouch. He was growing visibly more nervous. There will be, I think, a few old-fashioned bastards here and there who will refuse to sign. But they won't be prominent enough to make a noise. Nobody will hear about it. Their own communities and friends will turn against them for their being selfish, so it won't give us any trouble. We'll just take the patents over anyway.